afternoon, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, where we explore the interconnected systems shaping our world and the visionaries that are designing pathways towards resilient futures. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, CEO of ShoshimWorks, a global firm helping organizations thrive with ecosystemic models. Each episode, we dive into conversations with thought leaders, practitioners, and changemakers who are reimagining our relationship with natural and economic systems, technologies, and each other. We focus on those wicked societal challenges that are too large and too complex to be addressed by any single organization or sector alone. Problems that require unprecedented collaboration across government agencies, industry, academia, and civil society. From resource management to food security, from space to infrastructure, to resilient development, we're connecting the dots to help you navigate these complex challenges and opportunities they present. This series is provided by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with ShoshimWorks. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Shelley Brunswick to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast. Shelley is a CEO and founder of SB Global LLC and a visionary leader in the space innovation sector. With over 35 years spanning roles from the U.S. Air Force to Chief Operating Officer of the Space Foundation, Shelley has become a guiding force in connecting space technologies with sustainable development here on Earth. She's a prolific author, including her recent book, What Space Got to Do with It? 10 Life Lessons for Personal Growth, which explores how space innovation fuels leadership and problem solving across sectors. Shelley serves in numerous leadership positions, including the chair of Hot Airs, a global network. I don't know if I'm getting that right.
You are. Toad Air. It's French for air, so.
Fantastic. Hot Air, global network, and the Global Council for the Promotion of International Trade's Global Alliance for the Space Economy. Shelley, I've given the audience a brief glimpse, very brief glimpse into your achievements, but I'd love to have you start by telling us a little bit more about your journey and your vision and your work that you're focusing on now. So talk to us about your involvement in the space economy as well.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to join you. It's such a pleasure to be here and share some insights about the space industry and how it's benefiting people every day, sharing that insight with your audience. So thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Thrilled to have you here. Let's dive in.
So what I like to share with people is my journey has four chapters, just like many of your audience. We all pivot throughout our careers. And so the start of my career, my journey, was when I enlisted in the U.S. Air Force right out of high school. So probably similar to many of your audience listeners who are excited about space or curious about space. When I graduated high school, I didn't have college money. I really didn't know what I wanted to study, and I wanted to see the world. And one of the best ways to do that in the 1980s was to enlist in the U.S. Air Force, sign up for 4 years and get to see the world. And I was able to get stationed in Turkey and Germany, Colorado Springs at the Air Force Academy. And then I also learned a profession. So remember, I didn't have college money. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So the Air Force stationed me overseas. I earned college money, the Montgomery GI Bill, and I also got a profession. I was a personnel specialist. So yes, I was in the Air Force. I was not in the space industry yet. I was doing HR, and I was able to go to school at night and complete both my bachelor's and master's degrees. And so during that first chapter of my journey, 12 years as an enlisted airman, I then applied to become an officer in the Air Force. And that started my second chapter of my journey, where I became a space acquisition or space procurement officer for the Air Force. And I had a wonderful assignments working on ground station, rockets, satellites, teaching and being a professor at Defense Acquisition University, working on Capitol Hill as a legislative liaison, being a program manager. So it was a fantastic career opportunity. And that really started my 25-year career in the space industry when the Air Force made me a space acquisition officer. After 29 years in the Air Force, I knew it was time that it wasn't going to be a career. I thought about making it a career, but I decided it was time to move on to the next thing. I retired from the Air Force, and I started that third chapter of my journey, being the Chief Operating Officer at Space Foundation. So an incredible opportunity to take the leadership skills and that military space background I had and bring it into the commercial sector, really talking about commercial space, military space, civil and international space, as well as leading an incredible team, putting on some global events such as the annual Space Symposium that takes place every April in Colorado Springs that brings together the global space community. But also it was about capacity building. I did some capacity building, some workforce development when I was a professor at Defense Acquisition University, so adult training. But when I went to work at Space Foundation, I really understood the need for kindergarten through 12th grade and the importance of how we're creating the future generation to take the space jobs of the future. I also started the Space Commerce Entrepreneurship Program in partnership with the Minority Business Development Agency to unlock that innovation that entrepreneurs and investors can bring to the space industry. So after 9 incredible years at the Space Foundation, I knew it was time to reposition and relaunch. And then I started my own company, SB Global LLC. And that's what I'm doing today, being the bridge from the space industry to the general public and explaining how space is part of our everyday life. And you're already in the space business. If you're a company, you just don't know it.
100% could not agree with you more and so excited to have you here and see where this conversation goes. For our listeners, many of whom will be familiar quite with aerospace and space specifically, but maybe for those that don't, before we dive in, based on your perspective, right, and expertise, maybe just frame out the scope of what we're talking about when we talk about space. If you can maybe kind of put some shape and form to the space economy for our listeners, that would be super helpful.
Absolutely. Well, there's different fashions and forms of the space economy. So many of your listeners are probably thinking about what NASA is doing with the Artemis program, which is returning to the moon and this time to stay with partners from around the world. They're looking at building a gateway, which is kind of like a space station that will orbit the moon that allows astronauts to go back and forth to the moon and do activities, both research, but also look at a commercial activity called a cislunar economy, which is between the Earth and the moon, creating a new economic opportunities that will create new jobs. So a lot of times, people are thinking about returning to the moon under Artemis, which is, by the way, the twin sister of the Greek god Apollo. So that's how it got its name. There's also many people who are thinking about how we're moving on to Mars, with when will we have research centers on Mars and activities on Mars. Now, I do want to highlight we already are on Mars with multiple other countries doing activities on Mars. We have a rover on Mars. So it's very exciting. Some countries have already said they want to have a research center, such as the United Arab Emirates. They want to have a research center in the next 100 years on Mars. The U.S. wants to have humans on Mars. So it's a really exciting time as we're returning to the moon, going to Mars. And even this week alone, NASA has had multitude of scientific activities taking place where we're sending probes to other planets, moons, doing research on our sun, because our sun has weather that impacts the Earth. It's called solar winds and sun weather. So NASA's doing a lot of great research. And so a lot of times that's what our audience thinks about is the moon, Mars, and all this great research. But we're also wrapping that technology and bringing it back here to Earth, benefiting us every day. And one of the great forms is what we're doing right now. We're using telecommunications to record this interview, and telecommunications was brought to us by the Apollo era. So many people don't even realize that they're living on Apollo era technology. So I'll pause there because I'm excited to jump into how space is benefiting citizens every day right here on planet Earth.
I agree with you. And right, so many technologies that we just take for granted in our everyday lives were really ignited through the space work, the work over the past several decades in the space economy by NASA, by many others. And just kind of mapping those connections help us understand more our heritage and why space needs to continue to be even more a part of our future, right? So maybe walk us through some of those examples, if you can, Shelley. Which I know you can, but maybe what are some of the sciences, the technologies, and the big kind of sector impacts that we can anticipate that are the beneficiaries of the exploration and the work that's being done in space and for space?
Well, let's start with some numbers, because I know I've got some financial managers out there, some chief financial officers, some investors. I've got some entrepreneurs who are saying, why do I want to be part of space that has such a long-term return? So let's kind of just walk through the numbers. So In 2023, the global space economy was $630 billion and is projected by 2035 to be $1.8 trillion. Now, there's a lot of changes that are happening right now with the new administration in the U.S. driving space innovation that's causing more investors to want to come into the space industry. So that $1.8 trillion by 2035 could become accelerated and could happen sooner. We're also looking at, for your average citizen, that is a space nation, I'm going to highlight, because there are some countries that still are not connected to space. But on average, you're connecting to a satellite 45 times a day, according to the French Space Agency. Now, you may be looking at weather forecasting. You may be looking at GPS. You may be looking at your finances. So you're already connecting to a satellite 45 times a day. You just don't even know it. And for NASA, who's bringing this podcast to us, courtesy, I really want to highlight their investment, because they're investing on behalf of the U.S. taxpayers. And so for every $1 that was invested during the Apollo era, it was a $7 return on investment. And according to 2014, for every $1 NASA invests, it's a $40 return through their NASA spinoff technologies. So you can go, NASA has a great website, NASA spinoffs. You can look every year at all the great spinoff technologies. But I highlighted one of them. All of you are loving your iPhone or your cell phone, whatever it might be. And one of my favorite things in the cell phone is taking selfies. I mean, I'm one of those people. If I see you on the street, I want a selfie. Stop me. Let's get a selfie. Well, many of your phones are using NASA imaging technology. There's also algorithms in there. Think about GPSs in there, weather forecasting, all in your phone. But I'm going to share one of my favorite forms of Apollo era space technology, and that's fire retardant clothing. Because my husband was a firefighter for 30 years. And because of that Apollo era fire retardant clothing, he was able to come home safe every day. So those are just a few examples, and I could go on and on.
Those are great examples. I don't know what I would do without my GPS. So I'll just say it there. But yeah, no, it's a great point. And if we think about you kind of extrapolating that up to the economy at large, right? We are really, I think, challenging ourselves in the States here to really find greater economic growth, productivity, innovation. And I know that there are very strong ties between the roadmaps and the innovation that are forming the space economy. There are very strong ties to a lot of the economic sectors here on Earth. And very specifically, there's, I think, a brilliant example of the interdependency between the agritech and our food kind of supply chain and the work that's being done in space. Maybe just if you can walk us through some of those interconnected roadmaps and innovation roadmaps, I think that would be help make this real for a lot of our listeners and help our listeners understand the absolute imperative for space exploration and development and the collaboration with the folks that are building out the economies here on Earth.
Absolutely. Well, you talked about agriculture, and space and agriculture is so critical. Growing your own food is part of national security, whether you're in the United States or any other country. A country that can't feed its people doesn't have national security. And so how space is helping farmers is, one, is space through low Earth orbit and multiple satellites can take pictures of various agricultural fields and then provide imaging to tell you how healthy that piece of plot of land is. And it can give you some insights about, do you need water? Does it need fertilizer? Does it have pest management? And this type of technology can help farmers increase crop yields. It's also, you're not even thinking about some simple things. Right on your John Deere tractors is GPS. And by having GPS on your John Deere tractor, you can do precision agriculture, which allows you to have more streamlined and more increased growth by about 10% for agricultural growth. And then also in how you harvest. So using that GPS technology that's on your John Deere tractors and other tractors, I don't want to just select John Deere, you're increasing precision agriculture. So we're also looking at the planting season. We're looking at monitoring how healthy the crops are. We're also looking at harvesting. But then after you have the crops harvested, then how are they brought to market and how are they sent throughout the United States or other countries? And you're using GPS. GPS. So GPS is being used for a lot of the logistical transportation of goods and services, but also food around the world. So you're using space technology in every aspect of that agricultural growth, harvesting, shipping, all the way to the blueberries that were in my cereal this morning are all brought to us from space technology. And one of the people I want to highlight who does a wonderful job for the NASA Harvest Program is Dr. Catherine Nakalibi. She leads the NASA Harvest Program for Africa. She's a professor out of the University of Maryland, and she helps farmers around the world understand how space technology can help them increase their crop yields like we're doing here in the United States, because so many countries and small farmers are dependent on the food they grow themselves. I also want to highlight it's so important also with satellite technology, weather forecasting. Understanding, is there going to be a drought this year? And if there's going to be a drought, do you maybe not plant this year and you use your resources in another way to offset that? Because if you buy the seed and you plant and you have a drought, you've lost that investment. So could you do other things? Could you raise animals instead and look at buying feed and having that as your source of income? So really being able to understand weather forecasting, drought, is it going to be a really wet season? I know in Cameroon this past year, they had torrential rains that flooded a lot of the agricultural fields, and that allowed food supplies to come in from the World Food Bank and other places. So really understanding what's happening with the weather planning is critical to farmers. We used to have the Farmer's Almanac. Now we have satellite technology that helps farmers understand how the weather can impact their crop yields that year.
No doubt. It's so exciting. We're all quiet beneficiaries of this amazing work and capabilities. And it's just really inspiring to step back and think through all those many touches, right, in our daily lives, right, that are basically enriched based on the important work that's being done in pore space, right? And if we think about how that can inform the educational pathways, right, there are so many careers also that are being unlocked based on this new dimension of the human experience that is space, right? So space has been around for quite some time, but is really blossoming into just an incredible pathway for humanity, society, industry. And that really unlocks a lot of need for new skills, new education. So let's maybe walk back to that side of your journey and talk about how skills development, career pathways, and lifelong learning might be informed by what is now possible through the space economy.
Absolutely. So I'll start with my journey. As I said, I came in through the military to the space industry, and that is a traditional way into the space industry. The military or NASA are traditional ways into the space industry. So I had a traditional way, but then non-traditional. Because when we think back to the Apollo era, we were really looking at STEM professionals, science, technology, engineering, and math. And although we still need those careers today, I am not one of those careers. I actually have a business background and undergraduate in business and an MBA. So I'm more that commercial business side of space, the entrepreneurial side, those partners that partner with the government. So I have a traditional and a non-traditional way into the space industry. And so as we think back to the Apollo era, we really looked at STEM professionals. The government did the majority of the work. Now here we are today, and we're looking at this huge commercialization opportunity. And what commercial companies bring to the marketplace is new job opportunities. So yes, we still need astronauts and rocket scientists, but we need a strong, robust manufacturing sector, because we need welders and electricians and technicians that can build the rockets, that can build the satellites. So we need a strong supply chain that can do that. And again, related to national security, where is that supply chain located? We learned during COVID the importance of the supply chain. And during COVID, a lot of our aerospace and space companies were impacted by those manufacturers that were in the supply chain. So we need a robust supply chain, and we need to locate it close to home, close to America for national security. We also then need to look at all the commercial players. So there are some companies that are doing business with the government, rocket companies, satellite companies. And so they're primarily focused on government activities, and they can have some commercial activities because there are some laws called the International Traffic of Arms laws that restrict them from doing some sales. And so a lot of those are dual use technologies. They can be sold both to the government as well as to industry, but there are some requirements. You may need to be a US citizen and to work in their company, and there can be some other activities. And then there are fully commercial space opportunities where it could be not only in the United States, but it can be our partners around the world, whether it's Japan or Australia, the United Kingdom. We're looking at those full commercial opportunities. Again, think about some of the applications you're using every day, Airbnb, Uber. You don't think about them being space technology, but they're running on the platform of space technology and cybersecurity. Those businesses would not exist if it weren't for the infrastructure of space. And so there's opportunities for commercial opportunities that relate strictly to commercial. And what I wanted to highlight is for your audience, a great place to always look is the White House always provides a list of their emerging technologies. And emerging technologies could be healthcare. And again, that may or may not have a military application. Everybody wants to be healthy. We look at quantum technology. We look at artificial intelligence, virtual reality, advanced manufacturing. All of those emerging technologies also have an intersection with the space industry. And it could have a military government application, or it could have a totally benefiting humanity. So I talk about biotechnology, solving some of our challenges on Earth with cancer. Another great company called Lambda Vision is looking to help solve macular degeneration, which is an eye disease that affects people as they get older. They go blind. And Lambda Vision, in partnership with NASA and Space Tango, is 3D printing protein layered lens replacements for your eyes that could bring back vision to people who've lost their eyesight. Again, totally commercial application, but brought to us through space technology. So those are some of those. And then you kind of mentioned even the economic sector. Sometimes people put space in this little economic sector called space. And that's rockets and satellites and going to the moon. But space is actually intersecting every economic sector. So whether you're in agriculture, we talked about how it intersects with ag, it intersects with finance. Every time you're going to that ATM machine and you're putting in your card and you're getting money out, on that receipt is a date timestamp from a GPS satellite. Kind of an original form of blockchain, because that is what validates that transaction was legitimate, that your bank account wasn't hacked. So we're using fintech, the entire fintech cryptocurrency blockchain is also running on space technology. Energy and energy storage, as we look to go to the moon, can we mine helium-3? But also we can use Earth observation satellites to monitor oil and gas industries, monitor the pipelines, look at the flow and supply. So there's lots of great opportunities that relate to that commercial side, as well as the side that could be dual use. And I could go on and on, as you can tell, but it's really an exciting time for your audience to think about finding career opportunities in the space industry where they're passionate.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And listening to you, Shelley, I'm also thinking about our friends in the investment community out there, right? Because they have a kind of an appetite for risk and return, right? And a structured kind of order of things in which they invest. And space presents some unique characteristics, right? In some cases, longer development cycles, higher risk, less of a kind of an established infrastructure and kind of demand market. But if you are talking to our investor community that's listening today, what's your guidance for them to maybe frame their thinking about investing in these entrepreneurs?
Absolutely. Well, right now, the world is excited about investing in space innovation. I just returned from a wonderful conference in Saudi Arabia called LEAP, where there were 200,000 people that joined. But even more important, there were 1,000 investors. In the investor stage, where I interviewed Rafael Rotkin, who's an investor in space, and he told me he's getting more people coming out of the woodwork that want to invest in space. Coming out of the woodwork's a traditional kind of talk, but They're super excited about space innovation with the current Trump administration and the excitement about building a golden dome and going on investing in space for Mars. Investors are really excited about coming into the space industry, looking at commercializing the space industry. As a matter of fact, Rafael is an investor in that Lambda Vision, that macular degeneration solution that I talked about. So he invests in early stage space innovation, which is really exciting too, because finding early stage investors is always challenging because you haven't tested out your technology. But you know, one of the favorite places I love to look at is the NASA Tech Transfer Office. There are thousands of patents at the NASA Tech Transfer Office that are waiting for entrepreneurs and investors to commercialize. You can apply for the patent. You can look at applying for a Small Business Innovative Research Grant, SBIR, or an STTR grant to take that patent and look at taking it from technology readiness level 0 to maybe technology readiness level 4. And then you find an investor, an incubator that helps you take it through 5, 6, and 7, which sometimes we call the valley of death because it can be hard to find investors. And then once you get to TRL 7, technology readiness level 7, usually you can find investors that help you get it to commercialization. So right now, NASA, as well as the Department of Energy and the Air Force Research Lab and so many more government agencies, have this treasure trove of patents that are waiting for entrepreneurs and investors to invest in, commercialize, and create job opportunities throughout the United States.
I think there is a, just with this new administration coming in, there is such a strong emphasis on the space economy and the growth that it represents for humanity and our economy. The opportunities for investors, for new careers and mature careers alike to really lean into that is just tremendous. It's super exciting. And I'd love to touch back on your comment about your recent trip. And you've written extensively about how space initiatives will differ across countries and regions, but also necessitate basically international collaboration. So maybe walk us through your vision for how internet in the geopolitical landscape is quite dynamic. So maybe walk us through your vision for how collaboration informs our space economy.
Absolutely. Collaboration is critical. I do want to highlight we are in another space race, and this time it's for commercialization, because a lot of countries are looking at the United States and they see how we invested in the Apollo era and how we're now 60 years later still benefiting from that investment. And they want that same type of economic engine and opportunity for their country. Now, not every country has to invest like the United States. Not every country needs launch facilities or rockets or their own satellites or astronauts. Many countries can look at what benefits their people, their citizens. Some countries may not have access to the internet. A lot of island nations, we can't lay fiber optic cable to them. So the only way they can really get internet communications, earth observation information is through space and satellites. And so maybe those countries really can look at fractional ownership of a satellite. Maybe they don't need the whole satellite. Maybe these countries can go in together. They get a satellite together from an organization, a company that creates satellites, and they get what I like to call fractional ownership of that satellite and that technology. I wrote an article in Forbes Technology Council about it in July 2024. It was something I talked about at the World Economic Forum in 2024 about how we help these emerging space nations. Instead of having to go through the whole process like the United States, they can leapfrog and really look at what technologies they need and what benefit their citizens. So again, I highlighted a lot of emerging space tech countries are agricultural based still. And so having access to that earth observation, that weather forecasting, helping farmers understand how to plant, having access to the internet and telecommunications, because maybe they're not able to get on the internet and do global business. And so they're really still kind of isolated. So by having access to the internet, can they now create crops or products and services that can be sold globally? So some of the first things that developing nations can look at is telecommunications as well as earth observation, and look at partnering to buy those fractional satellites. And so I think that's one really good model. And there are companies both in the US but as well as globally that are looking at providing those opportunities.
No doubt. Yeah, no, there is an intense, I think, investment in operationalization of various space-based operations. And it's getting a little crowded. I know we haven't talked about this much, but it is getting crowded up there as well. How do we need to think through, again, thinking about those wicked problems that space also introduces for us? How do we think about congestion and coordination in those layers of space? Because we do have an issue with debris, right? We have an issue with congestion. It seems like there is a great opportunity for greater collaboration across nations, across agencies, in order to make this more accessible and sustainable.
Excellent question. So probably for your audience, they may not know that we've got a space junk problem. Sometimes we're not really good stewards of our planet, and we have some debris here. We need to be better stewards of cleaning up our planet, but we also have the same challenges in space. We have not really thought about launching things and parts and pieces come off of rockets or satellites that are old and no longer work are sitting there, and they're sitting in a position. So there's positions around the planet where you can put satellites to get the data or the telecommunications or the monitoring that you need. And so how do you remove or reuse the orbital debris that's there? So I won't call it junk, because I'm going to say we're going to reuse. So a lot of companies are coming out. We know some from Japan as well as the U.S. We have AstroScale, which is Japanese, but also located here in the U.S. They're looking at orbital debris removal. So can we remove orbital debris? Other companies like OrbitFab are also looking at how can we refuel? So can we have gas stations in space? So it used to be once you launched a satellite, it was gone. I mean, the fuel it had on it is all it had. And once it was done, now there's really a business case for refueling these satellites. There are also companies that are looking at, could we do some manufacturing in space? So can we look at some of these satellites and pieces that are out there, and can we now manufacture and repurpose them, reuse, recycle those satellites and pieces, and create new satellites to use? So there's a lot of companies that are looking at those three different areas. One, removal, two, refueling, and then three, manufacturing and reusing. So it's a really exciting time. And again, this is all being done by the commercial sector. Excitement, there's a business case, there's investment opportunities, there's a real ROI for those investors out there. And there are some great companies, like I mentioned, OrbitFab and AstroScale and many others that are looking at those activities. Oh, and let me highlight, you did mention the other one, space situational awareness. So that's kind of a military one, but space situational awareness is understanding all the parts and pieces that are floating out there and where are they? Because when a bullet hits a bullet, it's going to cause massive damage. So right now, think about every piece of orbital debris is traveling like a bullet, as is the International Space Station, as is all these satellites. So if a piece of orbital debris hits the International Space Station or hits a satellite, it's a bullet hitting a bullet. It can have catastrophic effects. So not only is the U.S. and U.S. Space Force looking at that space situational awareness and understanding all the orbital debris, which is needed for military, but also commercial importance for our satellites and our businesses that are using satellites. But we can't do that alone. We are partnering with other nations we call the Five Eyes, which are our allies like Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Canada, the UK. But we have some great partnerships with Japan and space situational awareness because the United States, we can't track everything. And we need that communication and collaboration to really understand what's happening out there with orbital debris to make sure we protect the International Space Station, future space stations, as well as the satellites and all these other assets that are in orbit.
No doubt. There are a lot of nuances and complexities that exist that we need to get kind of an infrastructure and operational protocols and kind of interoperability into the space logistics. And that requires not only coordination within our own space economy as a nation, but also with our international partners, right? So it's a complex landscape, but it represents tremendous opportunity. But to your point, tremendous responsibility. We need to be good stewards of not only our kind of environment here on Earth, but also what we're putting up there in space.
I did want to correct that Japan is not part of the Five Eyes. I want to make that clear. It's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the US, and the UK. But Japan has also been a great ally, and they're doing a lot of great investment in space, as well as space situational awareness. So I want to make that clear to our audience who might be World War II buffs that Japan's not part of the Five Eyes.
Yeah, no. Thank you for clarifying. Some of our audience may not be familiar, but I bet they do some research after this conversation. So this is great. And actually, to that point, for our listeners and for folks who want to start to engage more actively, or at least explore more actively, space innovation, space career pathways, educational pathways that might open up more options, you've shared just a wealth of resources, and I've been noting them down as we go. We'll put some of these in the show notes for folks, but what are some of the pathways that do exist that can help our listeners or their networks contribute to or benefit from the space economy more directly?
Absolutely. So let's talk about the careers. I talked a lot about the manufacturing, but we also need all the other careers. I talked about I was a program manager. I was a policy person. When I was at Space Foundation, I was in capacity building, and I had teachers working for me. I've talked about investors and entrepreneurs and artists. Think about all the people who are inspired by space, both from Star Trek and Star Wars. I also say there's a great show out there called How the Universe Works, and it's also online, and it's wonderful. It tells you about the science of how the universe works, but it also talks about Earth applications and different career fields. So basically, there are opportunities for everyone in the space industry, from high school graduate to PhD and everything in between. And these companies need everything from business development, marketing, telecommunications, leadership. So there's lots of great opportunities. So one of the things I highlight is my Interstellar Guide to Success, which helps you find your pathway. And your pathway could be in the space industry. So it's about awareness, access, and action. Awareness is what you're getting today. You're learning that there are opportunities in the space industry. So now the next step is, how do you find access points? So are there some great access points? NASA has some great stuff on their website. I talked about the NASA Harvest Program. I talked about NASA Tech Transfer Office. NASA has a lot of educational K-12, or the International Space Station also has a lot of stuff on their website. The ISS, I think it's called the ISS National Lab, has some kindergarten through 12th grade programming. If you're a parent or a teacher, you could take the students or your kids to a science center and learn about science. Or you could even just go out, find a place in your community that does stargazing and talk about the night skies. So there's access points that can be low cost. And then those action steps are about training, connecting, and mentoring. And when I mean training, well, if you want to be in the space industry and you want to be an astronaut, you're probably going to need formal education. You might need a PhD, but you could also be in the space industry and be in the manufacturing sector, and you might be able to get a certificate from a community college while you're still a senior in high school. So you could graduate and walk into a great manufacturing job. And some of the community colleges that I know of, like El Camino College in California, is one of those that offers those training certificates, and you can walk into a great paying manufacturing job. So right out of high school, you could walk into a great job or be an astronaut and everything in between. There are fellowship programs right now. One of my favorite fellowships programs is the Karman Project, run by two incredible women, Hannah Ashford and Ku Wang. And Ku Wang is also an investor in space, so you might want to look her up. But the Karman Project also has a fellowship program, and its applications are open right now until 31 March 2025. So you could apply to be a fellow. But there's also many other fellowship programs in the United States, the Brooke Owens Fellowship Program. So you could also apply for fellowships or internships. And for people watching that are 35 and under, one of my favorite places on LinkedIn for you is to sign up to watch Opportunities for Youth. They promote jobs, internships, scholarships. So again, training opportunities. Then I already started it. Build those connections. Where do you build those? You can build those by joining organizations like Women in Aerospace, Women in Defense, Women in Tech Network, the Space Generation Advisory Council. You can join these organizations or go to events. Like in DC has a big event coming up called Satellite Conference that's coming up in March every year. In April is the annual Space Symposium. But in January, normally in Florida, NASA has a Space Congress conference that takes place in Orlando. So you could go to one of these events and start networking, building those relationships with people in the space industry, finding opportunities, create a LinkedIn profile, create a resume or CV so you can share it with people. And then, of course, that third action step is find a mentor. There are many mentoring programs. I mentor for a great program called the GPODS, Global Policy, Diplomacy, and Sustainability Fellowship Program, out of a think tank. And that's a wonderful program. There is a cost, but there are some non-cost ones, such as Women Tech Network. And even though women's in the name, they're open to men and women to be both proteges as well as mentors. So I want to highlight many of these organizations may say women in the name, women in industry, but they're open to men and women. I know I used to be the chair of Women in Aviation, and WEA is open to men and women. We brought men on the board of directors as well. As a matter of fact, WEA was founded by men as well in the space industry. So men are women's allies in creating more opportunities in the space industry. So there's so many more opportunities I could share. Look at your local universities. They might have rover challenges that you could join, or they might have incubators and accelerator programs. And again, go to that NASA website, check out the opportunities that are available right there.
I love that. Just touching back on, you mentioned earlier, much earlier, the concept of fractional ownership of satellites. If we think about talent and talent pathways, there is also a very large and growing arena that offers us fractional access to jobs, right? Yes. So it's a great way through kind of fractional jobs, right? Fractional project support, open innovation are great pathways to establish access to space types of work or space types of networks. So you can connect into innovation marketplaces, talent marketplaces, and make connections into the space network and economy by contributing what you do best in a fractional way. So those are really great. And actually, NASA is a really great sponsor of both fractional talent and fractional innovation. They're world global leaders in making those connections much more accessible for folks through fractional engagements. So it's just really exciting to see all the on-ramps to the space economy for all of us. If we maybe, I know we're coming up on time, but I really would love to touch upon the future, your vision for the future. So if we look at maybe the path forward, what are some of the emerging, I guess, trends at the intersection of space technology and an environment and the economy that most excite you right now and the work that you're doing or the work that you want to do?
Well, that's a super question. I do want to touch on one of your comments, and in my book in chapter one, I talk about opportunities, and you talked about the fractional opportunities, but an opportunity that can help individuals come into the space industry is also volunteering to join organizations and maybe help them in some way. Can help you, whether it's Space Generation Advisory Council or WEA or the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs. There could be some volunteer opportunities that help you get networked into events. Or maybe you volunteer. International Astronautical Congress, or IAC, is taking place this year in Sydney, and they always need volunteers to help with that. And that allows you to have an opportunity to have access to this global space industry by being a volunteer to help with the event. So there's lots of opportunities, whether you're in social media or you want to be at the event floor in person. So volunteering is also one of those great ways to get into the space industry, beef up your CV if you need to add some skill sets in there. So look at that as well as fractional job opportunities. Mm-hmm. So now I'll pivot to what am I excited about? Well, one of the things I talked about at LEAP is I spoke on at LEAP. They also have a side conference called DeepFest. And DeepFest is about the emerging technology. So quantum and AI and the future of work. And what does this look like? And I was on an incredible panel talking about AI. And I was talking about space and AI. And I think that area and that intersection is super exciting. So whether we're thinking about space and AI for NASA and the research side of it, understanding the origins of our universe, unlocking that, understanding other galaxies and universes, understanding how we could, running through those simulations with digital twin and AI, how could we land on Mars? How can we survive? What is the technology? AI is going to help us get there so much faster for those off-world activities, but also on-world. When we tie AI in space with healthcare, I talked about a great healthcare one, but we're also doing research in space on cancer, the way cancer cells can grow in microgravity environment. So imagine taking a lot of these healthcare applications with space innovation and now AI. Think of all the things we're going to unlock to help humanity solve many of these challenges. Cancer, osteoporosis, there's so many diseases that we're looking at that we can solve with space innovation as well as AI. So I think AI is really going to be a big game changer. I also know another company called Kairos, but it's spelled X-A-I-R-O-S, like the Greeks, Kairos, for time. And they're looking at quantum and how we're going to replace the GPS clocks with quantum clocks. And that's in the near future as well. And so they're one of those emerging technologies as well. That's quantum and AI and space. So I'm looking at a lot of that, and I'm looking at space and the role of NASA and ESA and the other space agencies. ESA is the European Space Agency. I apologize to your audience. I was in the military, so we use a lot of acronym soup. So I apologize. What is the role of our government agencies going forward? 60 years ago, when it was the Apollo era, we didn't have an industrial base that could really provide all the things that we needed for a space industry. So NASA led that innovation, and we still need NASA to do parts and pieces, but really NASA can be that leader, that strategic thinker in how do we unlock innovation, entrepreneurship, investors, the commercial sector, just like we did for World War II when we unlocked the commercial sector for the war effort. We can unlock the U.S. innovations or partner countries to create that space economy for the future. And that's really a great role for NASA, the European Space Agency, JAXA, which is the Japanese Space Agency, Australia. Unlock our human capacity, our innovation, and our entrepreneurial spirit as we look to pursue going on to the moon and Mars and beyond, but also as we look to solve these earthly challenges.
So right. So right. So well said. And if we think about that, we just have to work together, right? There are necessary collaborations across sectors, across geopolitical boundaries. We have to come together, right, to solve some of these wicked opportunities, because there is so much potential, and our time and our experience here on Earth is only going to benefit from what we learn, what we do, and what we can create in space. As you mentioned, pharma is, I love some of the pharma use cases or experiments that are taking place today, where the microgravity environment really is unlocking a lot of exciting capabilities. So there's just so much that we can imagine and so much more that we can do together. If we think about really the listeners and kind of empowering them as we go forward from here, what are some of those questions that you wish more people would ask about the role of space innovation in creating more economic resilience, more innovation? How can we, in our day-to-day operations here, right, going back to, after listening to this, going back to our daily lives, how can we take space with us, right, and apply that to kind of how we're advancing our economy, advancing our innovation in more resilient futures?
Absolutely. Well, let me give you an example, and then I'll give you some solutions. One of the examples is I went to a scholarship lunch event for scholars at the Colorado State University Pueblo, and I helped sponsor one of the scholars for space leadership. And my scholar, amazing individual, comes from a rural community that didn't really think space was for him. He didn't even think he wanted to go to college. He was going to go to be an electrician, but because he got some scholarships, he was able to go to college. He's getting a mechatronic degree. He's a genius. He wants to get a physics minor. And when I ask him about space, you know what he says? He goes, well, space just seems too big to me. I'm not sure it's for me. And had I not been his mentor and sponsor, he probably wouldn't even be thinking about space. So I think what we need to do, and this is a great role for NASA, as well as government organizations like the U.S. Space Force, Space is not this thing on a shelf that's only for some people. It's like the scholar told me, it's too big. I just don't think about it. It's not too big. It's for you. And here's what we can do between teachers, community leaders, and parents. For teachers, what we really need to do as we're reevaluating our curriculum is we need to look at how we bring space into the day-to-day classroom, making things hands-on, immersive, bringing in that emerging technology, making it exciting, showing how these skills lead to jobs, and we need to make it fun, engaging, and relevant. Right now, a lot of times space is about history. It's about the Apollo era, or it's about memorizing the planets. And if you want to do space, you have to do it in an after-school activity. So we're missing a lot of kids that might have to go home and take care of siblings, or they have a part-time job. They can't get involved in these after-school activities. We've got to bring space and the jobs and the technology and careers into the classroom. Critical. The next thing is community leaders. What can you do to help sponsor a class, help bring that space or innovation into the classroom? If your company is open for tours, like maybe United Launch Alliance or Blue Origin or Orbit Fab or Lockheed Martin, can you bring kids in to see what you do and what the different careers are and the technology you're building so they can see? Because when kids can see it, then they know they can be it. Or could you volunteer to be a science fair judge or give talks at the school so they can at least understand how space plays out and how they can have a role? And then for parents and grandparents, take your kids and take the neighbor kids and take their friends. Go out and go stargazing. Go to some science centers. Jump on the NASA website together and pull one of those kindergarten through 12th grade activities. And you could do some hands-on activities with your kids or the neighbor kids and help them understand how space is part of our everyday lives and make it more personable. So it's a way for everyone to get involved, whether it's family, it's community, or it's teachers.
So well said. You just, one of our earlier projects with the NASA team was an open innovation engagement called Futurescaping Our Skies. And I will never forget one of my favorite projects ever. The winners of this open innovation projects, the project was a father and his 2 8-year-old daughters. And it was basically, the mission was to imagine the future of space, based on what we understand today, doing some think tank work for space futures. But this father worked with his 2 8-year-old daughters to just imagine the future of space and the future of humanity 50 years out because of space. And they did a beautiful job and they took home the prize. So I think there's so much opportunity for us to all kind of take personal responsibility for where the future takes us and what role space has to play in that. So Shelley, I know we're coming up on time and there is so much more here, but you've done so much already. You're basically shining the light for the rest of us to follow. If our listeners would like to follow you, where can they learn more about your work, your book, and stay connected with your talks and your publications and all of your great work?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I do have the Shelley Brunswick website. So shelleybrunswick.com is a great place to look because I do have some more books in the pipeline, but I practice what I preach. I told you all to join LinkedIn and I do post everything on LinkedIn. I'll be posting another activity coming up. I'll be at Swinburne University in Melbourne in 2 weeks. So for those of you who are Aussie friends, I'll be seeing you soon down under. So I do post my activities on LinkedIn. I also post where I'm going to be or what I've done, talks, articles, insights. And then of course, I'm also on Instagram and X. So follow me and let's stay connected. I'm excited to see the rest of you around the galaxy.
I love it. I love it. All right. So the top 3 points, listeners are going to be walking away into very busy lives. What are the 3 big recommendations that you have for them?
Well, I'm going to start with, you're already in the space industry. You just don't know it. So how can you benefit from space? 2, what do you want to do with space? How can you inspire not only yourself, but the next generation to find those amazing career opportunities? And 3, take action. Take action. What can you do today that could help inspire the next generation? Are you a community leader? Are you a teacher? Are you a parent? Each of us can do something that helps inspire not only the next generation, but even this generation, because we need people mid-career to come into the space industry. So what can you do? What's one step you can take today to inspire innovation, entrepreneurship, and unlock the space in your daily lives?
Let's do this. Let's do this. I love it. Shelley, thank you so much. You're absolutely an inspiration for all of us, and you've made the path forward so much easier for all of us as well. So thank you. We're all following in your digital wake, just so you know, and keep up the good work, and we'll do our best to do our part.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and for all your audience, I look forward to seeing you around the galaxy.
Excellent. And for our listeners, that brings us to the end of today's conversation with Shelley Brunswick. I want to thank you, Shelley, again, for sharing these incredible insights and your amazing work regarding how space technologies are addressing society's most complex challenges through unprecedented collaboration. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to Ecosystemic Futures wherever you get your podcasts and consider leaving us a review. It helps others find this important work and these great conversations. Thank you again.